Ever wonder if you can drink so much that you literally can't be found guilty of murder?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question.
I know, right? But it's exactly the kind of curveball we're dealing with in State v. Brown.
It's a fascinating New Mexico case that went all the way to the Supreme Court and really forces you to think about what guilty even means.
Yeah, and for all you law students out there, this is a classic example of how intoxication can play into that whole mens rea thing you're studying.
The mental state required for a crime.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
And in this case, it's specifically about depraved mind murder.
Okay, so we're talking serious stuff here. We're going deep into the actual Supreme Court opinion, plus some extra background materials to get the full picture.
Absolutely. We'll break it all down so you can see how the court tackled this really tough question. Can being super drunk actually negate the mental state you need for a first-degree murder conviction?
Buckle up, everyone.
Yeah, this one's a doozy. We're talking about a guy, James Brown, who apparently drank 4.5 cases of beer.
4.5?
Cases, yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of beer.
And this all ends with him shooting someone in the back of the head.
Okay, so before we get to the really heavy stuff, set the scene for us. What led up to this whole tragic event?
All right, so the victim in this case is a guy named Oscar Zapata. And as I said, Brown had been drinking heavily throughout the entire day. It was later in the evening that he ended up at a gathering, kind of a small get-together.
Gotcha.
It was there that he met Zapata for the first time. Just a brief introduction, you know, shook hands, said hello. Nothing out of the ordinary at that point. Brown continued to drink, though.
Right. So far, it sounds like a typical, albeit extremely boozy night.
Exactly. But then it takes this really dark turn.
Yeah, because this is where it becomes a murder case.
Right. At some point during this gathering, Brown goes into a bedroom. Zapata and another person are lying on the bed, and Brown just shoots Zapata in the back of the head. No warning, no provocation, no prior conflict between them at all.
Jeez. Just out of nowhere.
It's brutal, really.
What was the Brown side of the story? What did he say when he was put on trial?
Well, Brown testified that he was so drunk, so incredibly intoxicated, that he had absolutely no memory of the shooting, claimed he blacked out completely.
A classic blackout defense.
Exactly. And he really emphasized that he'd only just met Zapata that night. He had no reason, no motive to hurt him.
Interesting that the prosecution apparently didn't present a clear motive either.
Right. It just adds to this sense that this act was totally senseless.
Okay, so we have this horrific act, and the guy claims he can't remember any of it. But he's charged with first-degree depraved mind murder. So for our listeners who might not be totally familiar with legal jargon, break down what that charge actually means.
All right, so this is where we get into the really crucial legal stuff. In New Mexico, at the time of this case, first-degree depraved mind murder wasn't just about killing someone.
It's about the mindset, right?
You got it. The mens rea, the mental state.
Yeah. We talk about that a lot on the show.
Absolutely. And for depraved mind murder, the prosecution had to prove that Brown had something called subjective knowledge. He had to be subjectively aware that what he was doing was creating a very high risk to other people's lives. It's not enough that a reasonable person would know shooting someone is dangerous.
He himself, in his own mind, had to be aware of that danger.
Exactly. It's not a should have known standard. It's about his actual state of mind at the moment he pulled the trigger.
That's a really key distinction.
Totally. Think of it like this. Imagine someone driving way too fast through a school zone. If they know they're speeding and they know there's a risk of hitting kids, that's more like subjective knowledge.
Okay, I'm following.
But someone speeding who's distracted, maybe not even processing the danger, that's different.
Different mental state.
Right. The law sees those as different levels of culpability. And that difference between knowing and should have known is where the intoxication defense comes in.
Makes sense. It's not just about being drunk. It's about how the law demands a higher level of awareness for certain crimes.
And that's why a defense that might not work for something like reckless driving might have more weight in a depraved mind murder case.
Okay, so Brown's lawyers basically said, my client was so wasted, he couldn't have formed that specific intent, that subjective knowledge. How did they try to make that argument in court?
They asked for a very specific jury instruction. They wanted the judge to tell the jury that they had to consider Brown's intoxication level when deciding if he had the subjective knowledge needed for depraved mind murder.
That seems like a pretty standard request in a case like this.
You'd think so, right?
What happened?
The trial court refused.
They just flat out said no.
They said the jury could consider the intoxication evidence as part of the overall circumstances, but not specifically in relation to subjective knowledge for depraved mind murder.
Wow. That seems like a pretty big blow to Brown's defense.
Yeah, it basically tied their hands, and guess what?
He was convicted.
Convicted of first-degree depraved mind murder. So his lawyers appealed, and that's how this whole thing landed in the lap of the New Mexico Supreme Court.
Right, and at that point, the big question was whether the trial court screwed up by not giving that jury instruction. So, what did the Supreme Court decide?
They ruled in Brown's favor. They said, yes, the trial court messed up by refusing that instruction. It was a big win for Brown's side.
Interesting. So, let's break down why the Supreme Court came to that conclusion. Why was it so important for the jury to be specifically told to consider Brown's intoxication when thinking about his mental state?
The majority opinion, written by Justice Franchini, made a really strong point. They said that being intoxicated, especially as drunk as Brown apparently was, can definitely mess with a person's ability to have subjective knowledge.
Like, it impairs their judgment so much that they can't fully grasp the danger of their actions.
That's the idea. Their perception of risk is all screwed up. And since depraved mind murder requires that specific subjective awareness, understanding the huge risk to life, the court said that evidence of extreme intoxication becomes super important.
So by not giving that instruction, the trial court basically prevented Brown from properly arguing his defense.
That was their reasoning. And to really hammer it home, the majority opinion included this powerful sentence. Intoxication may prevent a person from subjectively realizing their act creates a very high risk to others.
That's a pretty clear statement.
Yeah. And the court ultimately concluded that not giving the instruction was reversible error, meaning the conviction couldn't stand. Brown was granted a new trial.
Wow, so that one jury instruction could have made all the difference.
Absolutely.
But of course, there's always another side to these legal battles. We can't forget about the dissenting opinion,
Of
right?
course. Justice Minsner wrote the dissent, and his main concern was about the evidence of Brown's intoxication. He argued that while Brown said he blacked out, there wasn't enough proof to show that his intoxication actually meant he wasn't aware of what he was doing at the moment of the shooting.
So he wasn't convinced that just because Brown couldn't remember, he couldn't have understood the danger at the time.
Right. Just saying, I blacked out isn't automatically a get out of jail free card.
Makes sense.
And Justice Minsner also worried about a slippery slope. He said if we let extreme intoxication negate subjective knowledge for this crime, where do we draw the line for other crimes?
Interesting point. What if someone claims they were too high to know what they were doing during a robbery, for example?
Exactly. He was concerned about blurring the lines between different levels of criminal responsibility. He was basically saying, we have to be careful about relying solely on someone's word that they were too messed up to know what they were doing.
Okay, so a valid concern from the dissent. So stepping back, what are the big takeaways from State v. Brown? Why should law students care about this case?
Well, State v. Brown is a major case in New Mexico law because it clarifies how important that specific mental state, that subjective knowledge of extreme risk, is for first-degree depraved mind murder, especially when someone's intoxicated.
And it sets a precedent, right?
Absolutely. Prosecutors now have a higher bar to clear in these kinds of cases. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had that subjective knowledge, even if they were drunk.
So if someone in New Mexico is charged with depraved mind murder and they were drunk, their defense can argue that the intoxication prevented them from understanding the risk.
Exactly. It gives them a very specific legal argument to make. But, and this is important, this mainly applies to what we call specific intent crimes.
Where the mental state, the intent, is a key element.
Right. It doesn't necessarily work for crimes that are more about negligence or recklessness, where it's more about what a reasonable person would have done.
So State v. Brown is all about that distinction between subjective and objective mental state.
Yes. And it shows how messy things can get when you factor in something like intoxication, especially for a crime that hinges on very specific mental requirements.
You know, this deep dive has really highlighted the importance of understanding mens rea. It's not just some abstract concept you learn in law school. It can literally be the deciding factor in a murder trial.
It's at the heart of criminal law.
Absolutely.
And this case also leaves us with some really big questions, like how far should the law go when considering someone's altered mental state, especially when it comes to intoxication?
Right. Like, is it fair to hold someone less accountable for their actions just because they were drunk or high?
It's a tough question. And on a practical level, how do juries actually figure out what someone's awareness really was when their mind was clouded by substances?
Yeah. There's no easy answer.
It's a debate that continues to shape how we think about criminal justice, how we balance holding people accountable with making sure the law is applied fairly.
It's fascinating stuff.
And for those of you who want to go even deeper, I encourage you to look into how other states handle these issues of intoxication and criminal intent. You'll find a whole range of approaches and perspectives.
And that's exactly the kind of thinking we want to inspire here on the LexLit podcast. So until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.
And stay curious.